something now.
What do you hear? What do you hear?
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me? There's a... No, it's not working. It worked 5 minutes ago. Are we good? Are we good? We're not good. We are not good. Do 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 do. Nathaniel, is it working?
You know, your hand signals are a little bit confusing. Don't go scuba diving until you start that shit out.
Yeah, yeah.
That stuff.
It's okay. Out. Good call. There you go. There you go. Yeah. Good? We can start? Hi, I'm Elena Mossoff, Associate Artistic Director for Acting Upstage. We're talking today about the Tapestries concert, which is coming up in a week. I have been involved in this concert since I have been a part of Acting Upstage, so this will be my third concert. And what I've done is helped weave the concert together, the brilliance of Reza Jacob's music, together with text and sometimes some actors, to help create a flow for the evening. And it's been a lot of fun, and I feel like we've been fine-tuning that process over the last few years and playing around with different ideas, and this year is definitely different than the last two, in that we're not using actors, we're going to be using sound recordings from the layman, shall we say. And I'm sitting here with Reza Jacobs, who is a composer, sound designer, and music director with degrees from NYU Tisch, Columbia, and the Curtis Institute of Music. He has worked extensively in Toronto and abroad, from as close by as the U.S. to and all the way to Cambodia. For Acting Upstage, Reza has music directed 3 of our musicals and 4 of our concerts. Well, it will be 5 as of a week today.
Wow.
Wow. So, Reza, how's it going?
It's going very well. This is the first day of the final week before the concert.
And do you feel ready?
I feel in a good place. I mean, the timing works in such a way that... we cross the finish line just as we need to.
It's always like that.
It is always like that, but it's a system that's worked really well for us for the last few years. And so I feel ready for where I am right now.
So what does the rest of the week look like then for you to get to that finish line?
There are several elements.
Okay.
One of the main elements is my rehearsal with the 4 amazingly talented girls, Sarah Farb, Kelly Holliff, Eden Richmond, and Amadna LeBlanc, who sing all the backups in the show, sometimes all 4 together and sometimes in pairs. And they also each sing a solo and they each sing a duet. And so I'll be rehearsing with them every night this week.
Wow.
And then Saturday they have off. Sunday I'm rehearsing with the band. And Monday is the show.
And we have rehearsal Sunday night with it.
Exactly. We have a rehearsal Sunday night as well with the entire cast.
Awesome. And you're confident you're going to get through everything with them. I mean, they definitely help carry the concert in a way absolutely. That is integral, that has become integral.
Yes.
In the process.
Yes, absolutely. I feel I have complete confidence in those 4 girls, which is why I keep working with them. First of all, on a technical level, they always sing in tune.
That's harder than it sounds.
It's harder than it sounds, but also what's remarkable about them is that I never have to worry about their technical proficiency. Right. It's something that's just, they handle that and we just go and focus on the art rather than the technique. And then they are committed to the project and love doing it. And they're all phenomenal actresses and singers.
Totally. I recall, like, in talking to you about the concert and about the 4 of them in particular, there's something also quite unique about the way their 4 voices blend together, and you said that that's a very kind of rare thing. Can you speak to that?
Well, you just said it, which is that the 4 of them blend perfectly together, and that's a partly chance, but it's mostly that they have great ears. They listen to each other and they make the adjustments instinctively in the moment.
That's awesome. So in the concerts we've worked on together, we, you know, as far as back as I remember, we've looked at the music of Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell. Last year we did was The Long and Winding Road, and we examined the relationship between John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And this year we're looking at Carole King and James Taylor. Can you speak a bit about your personal connection to those two artists? And
Well, James Taylor, I fell in love with as a teenager, and I remember listening to his Greatest Hits album just on repeat and always harmonizing with it in a way that I'm sure annoyed a lot of people. But I love doing it. They're great songs to sing along to. James Taylor has an everyman quality in his writing and in his voice, which invites people to sing along. Mm-hmm. And the female equivalent really is Carole King. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only were they friends and collaborators and played on each other's albums, but in the way that James Taylor is the everyman, Carole King is sort of the everywoman, you know? And I think that's why her seminal album, Tapestries, spoke to an entire generation. And it's an album that I bonded with my mother over, and I feel a great connection to it, but I'm not alone in that. I think everybody feels a great connection to both those artists because of their every man, every woman quality.
Will your mom be coming to the concert to share in the music with you?
She sure will. She arrives on Friday, I think.
Where is she coming from?
She's coming from Vancouver, and my dad arrives on Thursday, and he's coming from Kuwait.
Amazing.
Yeah, quite a trek. And I
just for the concert?
Just for the concert, exactly.
Those are some good parents you have there.
Very good parents, you know.
So do you choose which artists interpret the music in the concert? How, I mean, I know, but let's tell our listeners how we make those choices.
Well, it's a very collaborative process. It's you and Mitchell and I sort of sit down and toss some names around, and then we're also collaborating with the universe, because it has to do with people's availability, and sometimes people say they're available, and then as life happens, you know, suddenly they become unavailable. So I always just trust, as with any sort of casting process, that we'll end up with the right people.
Mm-hmm. And how do you choose the songs?
Well, we start with a list of all the songs that we love or connect to, and in this case started with all the songs that we knew existed written by them, which is, I mean, an insane catalog, especially from Carole King, because as a writer, as you know, she wrote for other people as well. Mm-hmm. So we start with that list, and then we all get in a room together and just start weeding it down to the selections that we want in the show or would like to have in the show. And then we propose songs to artists, and that ultimately is the final phase, where the artists either connect with the songs or they don't connect with the songs. And so ultimately it is about the artists being happy. And then we put it together into a great running order, what we hope is a great running order.
Awesome. So how has your process changed over the years that you've been creating these concerts?
Well, I think as with anything, the more you do something, the better equipped you are to do it again. It's sort of like, you know, running your toboggan down a hill. The more times you run that path, the deeper that groove gets, right?
Mm-hmm, so totally.
I'm just more familiar with what the ride looks like. And so there is an ease that has come into the process for me personally. Mm-hmm. That was more of an unknown, say, 4 years ago, 5 years.
Right. As an observer, I would say that it seems like you've become more disciplined with the timeline
for yourself,
so you don't go crazy close to the last week or where we are now.
Yes.
You're not scrambling. There's a greater sense of what you need to do to get to that finish line, as you said earlier.
Yes.
We had a question from Tamara, which is, if you could jam with any musician, living or dead, who would it be and why?
Let's say John Lennon.
Okay.
But the primary reasons would be just for the conversation more than anything else.
And what do you think that conversation would be?
I think one of the reasons I'm drawn to it is because with John Lennon, there's no telling what it would be. But there's also a possibility that he would just be a little bit ornery, maybe even a little bit aggressive, and just have no interest in talking to me. And that possibility is exciting.
So it would just be about sort of testing what that conversation would be about as opposed to the conversation itself.
Absolutely. It would be, like, honestly, it's about wanting to be in the room with his energy, whatever it is. You know, because when people, especially with someone who's passed away or was assassinated in such a dramatic way, their legend tends to grow way beyond the man itself, you know?
Absolutely.
And so I would be interested in hanging out with the guy, the man, you know, divorced of the myth and the legend.
Interesting.
Yeah.
When you're composing sound for a play,
like sound design,
yeah, how much does your process change based on the director, and I will add the team that you're working with?
Well, I think as with any sort of group of friends or with family relationships, depending on the vibes of the people in the room, the process changes, because some people are a little more anxious, some are more relaxed. What I've learned over the years is that, and what I try to put into practice, is that I need some sort of consistency in what I bring to the table, so that I'm not just blowing around in the wind. It's sort of like being a tree, right? Which is, depending on the weather, i.e. the team, your branches might blow or the leaves might fall, but the roots have to be anchored in the ground. They have to be rooted and solid. And so I try and bring a consistent process, which is to read the play, to talk to the director about his or her vision, to take that away and then filter it through my own creativity, and then come up with proposals to bring back to the director. And I hope that it's then a conversation. And I've been very blessed in that everyone I've worked with, it has always been a conversation and a collaboration.
As opposed to being dictated to.
Exactly.
Which would probably be your worst nightmare.
Yeah, it's just something I'm not interested in.
Yeah, well, fair enough. I'm not sure anyone is.
Yeah, right?
It just kind of happens sometimes.
Yeah.
So I just want to explore your theatrical history. So were you in plays as a young person?
I was.
Like, did you ever play Tree Number 3 or The Rock?
I played Rat Number 11.
In the Nutcracker?
In the Pied Piper story. No, yeah, they mixed the Pied Piper story with, like, Sleeping Beauty or something like that. This is in Kuwait when I was very young. And I remember being absolutely devastated that no one thought that I could be the prince.
Why do you think that was?
They chose a very confident young man of maybe 9 years old, named Bassam. This was in Kuwait. And I was relegated to being a rat. Actually, it was a bit of a traumatic experience, because I remember we all had to get dressed in the music room. And one day I put on the wrong tights, and they were way too short. And so they kept slipping down.
Oh.
And the entire time I spent in the audience, moving around as a little rat, pulling up my tights. And I remember afterwards, the teacher said, "That was a good performance, guys, but who was the rat that kept, like, fidgeting with his uniform, with his costume?" And I absolutely did not raise my hand. I did not own up to that one at all.
You were embarrassed about your fidgeting.
I didn't want to admit to it.
Well, fair. Sure. So was that the end of your theatrical career? Was the rat
for a long time?
And then what? What brought you back?
Well, when I was in college at Columbia, like, I was doing a history degree, but in my junior year, I was asked to write the music for what was called the Varsity Show, and that's a show that has a lot of history to it. It's done every year, and it's a completely original musical done every year in collaboration with the actors, and there's a creative team, and it goes back, I think it goes back into the 1800s, actually, And, you know, people like Rodgers and Hart did it. And so there's a tremendous legacy of and a tradition associated with the show.
Fair. So did you start in music? And if you didn't, how did you end up in theater as opposed to just being a singer-songwriter or having a band as a musician?
Well, I credit my connection with musicals to my grandmother, because when I was growing up in Kuwait, we didn't have a lot of English TV. So she would go to England every year and she would record musicals and the things that she thought my sister and I should be watching. They happened to be musicals, things like My Fair Lady, Singing in the Rain. I mean, that was very powerful for me. That was one of the first musicals I remember and that I remember loving. Mm-hmm. Things like My Fair Lady, all the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers musicals. So she really is the one who started my love of musicals. And then I didn't really think about it as something to do or work in. I was pursuing a classical concert piano career. Mm-hmm. And that's where I went to music school at a place called Curtis in Philadelphia for 2 years. But I didn't quite fit right there at Curtis. It didn't feel right. So I left and tried to do a history degree at Columbia. I did a history degree at Columbia. And over there, I discovered a cappella music, and I joined an a cappella group, and I started to figure out how the skills that I had developed in my classical training could now be applied to a more popular medium. Mm-hmm. And then the Varsity Show was the first time that I considered or was asked to write a musical.
So what is it you love about working in theater? What keeps you rooted in theater?
The people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love collaborating with people. I love what is possible in a room with great minds. And also on a personal level, great minds and great hearts as well. Mm-hmm. And on a personal level, it's just something I have to do. I have to create. And one of the things I like about theater is that there's a lot of variety as well. You know, like there's some things that are more music heavy, some things in different genres of music. Different skill sets, like sometimes I'm working in a more recorded medium, like using synthesized sounds. Other times it's more about acoustic instruments. So it's, the variety keeps me interested. I'm not good with doing just one thing.
Fair enough. So do you compose music that isn't theatrical? And if so, tell me a bit about it.
Yeah, I improvise several times a week. Mm-hmm. Some weeks it's every day. And other times, if I'm doing a lot of work, I'll go a week or so without improvising. But I sit at my piano and I record my improvisations. Mm-hmm. So I have hours and hours of improv music. And I do that not just with the piano. I'm always playing the keyboard, but sometimes I use the keyboard to trigger other sounds, be it other instruments like a cello or a flute or something more synthetic, like an actual, like a Moog synthesizer or a drum machine, and I will record just a long improv, and then I'll go back and improvise along with that improv. Like, so yeah. I can just create music that doesn't have a purpose, that doesn't have to go with any sort of piece, doesn't have to please anyone, and most importantly, doesn't even have to please me. Because I think it's really important as artists to make sure we're creating without stakes sometimes, because mm-hmm. that's the kind of freedom we want to be able to achieve when we are creating and there are stakes.
Right.
You know?
Right. So you play with yourself a lot then. I've heard that. So, no innuendo intended, but I've heard you and your own recordings where you loop your own voice and then you play up sort of on top of it.
Yes.
That's what I mean in terms of playing with yourself and improvising with yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's pretty awesome. For those of you who are just joining us, I am currently talking with composer and music director Reza Jacobs, who is composing and music directing our annual Tapestries concert, which is on Monday, November 26th at Kerner Hall at 8 p.m. There are still tickets available.
There are?
There are. Just a few, though. Better get them quickly. So, what's your favorite musical and your favorite musical composers?
Oh, gosh. Well, years ago, I answered Little Shop of Horrors, and I still have a soft spot for that piece.
Have you ever done it?
I've never done it.
Okay.
It would be a fun one to do.
Uh-huh.
Sondheim really speaks to me a lot,
mm-hmm.
As he speaks to many people.
Yeah.
You know, because the humanity in it is captured flawlessly in the writing. And also rhythmically, he writes with the inflection and rhythmic gesture of human speech, as opposed to, he just does it better than many other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
He's kind of mastered it.
He has mastered it.
Yeah, I mean, he has mastered it, not kind of.
He's the template, really. You know?
Right.
I loved Caroliner Change. It was
a
pleasure to work on that.
Mm-hmm.
That had many of the pluses that I've just identified in Sondheim. You know, so that was a piece that meant a lot to me. Assassins as well. These are pieces I've worked on, you know, Assassins and Caroliner Change, but so I have a connection to them that I don't have to ones that I haven't worked on.
Right. They kind of get under your skin in a way.
Yeah. And what both those pieces in particular have in common is that the text is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
The text is flawless.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm way more interested in working on pieces that aren't your run-of-the-mill pieces that are just crowd pleasers. I'm much more interested in working on musicals that have substance, that are different from the norm, that surprise people's expectations, and most importantly, where the words mean something. Because
mm-hmm.
if the words don't mean anything, I'm not interested.
It's a good thing you work for us, then.
Yes. That's why I love acting upstage.
That's why we love you. So what instruments do you play? Obviously, you're a very accomplished pianist, and we, you know, last year at the concert, we watched you duke it out on the piano in that amazing improvised duel with Mike Ross, which is down in my historical memory as one of the greatest musical moments I've ever experienced of all time.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Well,
my family is still talking about it, and they don't talk about music, so that's pretty amazing. So what other instruments do you play? What do you, or even dabble in?
Well, I've just been trying to pick up the harmonica. I bought a harmonica in Halifax, so I'm trying to pick that up. It's on my list to pick up the guitar, but I probably won't get to it until this summer.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, I only play piano, but I'm able to write for different instruments because I use the piano through the miracle of technology to trigger the sounds of other instruments, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, you know. It's easy to feel somehow inadequate because I only play the one instrument. But hey, we all have our battles, right?
Yes. Would you? I mean, you said you're gonna try picking up the guitar in the summer. Do you find that you have an easier time learning instruments because you are musically inclined, or is it just as hard for you to learn another instrument as it would be for me to just pick up a guitar because I'm not totally musically inclined?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing that would make it easier is a familiarity with music and chords, so that I can at least do some self-assessment as
mm-hmm.
I learn a new instrument. So I think therein lies the advantage of already playing the piano.
Right. So I'm just curious about what you like to do for fun. I know you're super into music, and you've said in your spare time you sometimes improvise and musical jam.
Mm-hmm.
But like, what do you do that's not musical or theatrical? Do you, like, what are your favorite interests? Sports? Do you play sports? It feels like a funny question sometimes in the theater, asking someone if they play sports or hobbies or games.
Well, I do things that I think a lot of other people do, which is I try to make time for my friends, my dear friends, and I try to spend time with them in a way where I can actually connect with people,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to just sort of surfacey, sort of just having lots of acquaintances, you know?
Right.
And I try to schedule. Now, as you mentioned earlier, I'm getting a lot better with scheduling, and I'm realizing that it actually gives you a lot of freedom. So
mm-hmm.
if you have a solid structure in place, you can actually have more freedom. So I actually am able to make time, plan to have time with the people that I care about. And also time with myself, you know, because if you don't recharge the battery, you're not going to be able to give anything.
That's something I'm learning.
Yes.
Very much. You are a cook. I feel like every time I come here, there's something brewing on the stove or in the oven. You like good food. This is a hobby.
It's a very charitable assessment to call me a cook.
But a charitable assessment?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't really consider myself a cook, but I do out of necessity, financially and also in terms of time, I do make my own food a lot. And I make a lot of kale. You've eaten a lot of kale here.
I've eaten a copious amounts of kale with Reza Jacobs.
Absolutely.
If you're going to hang out with Reza, expect kale.
Expect it.
Expect kale. So, okay, well, you're obviously, like, hyper inclined to music in a way that is inspiring. Is this something in your genetics? Or is there musicians in your family?
My grandfather used to sing at parties a lot.
Okay.
And, I mean, not because he was asked, just because he did.
Right.
And,
was he good?
Yeah, he was good.
Okay.
I remember his voice being very powerful. And, I know that he really loved singing.
Do you have recordings of him?
I don't think so, but that's a good question. I should ask my family if there are any recordings. He did do it at pretty much every gathering. So,
really?
Yeah. And my dad...
What would he sing? Like, would he sing traditional music or what was...
One of the songs I remember is Mona Lisa. He'd be like, Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, but like very operatically, you know, and very richly. Uh-huh. And he would always sing it to my grandmother. And I think she was a little uncomfortable with that, being very humble as she is. But
Was it because he was singing to her publicly, you think?
Yes.
Yeah, it was about the public display.
Yeah, she's just allergic to the attention.
So what's your first music memory?
That is a good question. What is my first music memory? It's tough because I've seen a photo of me at the piano as a really, like, maybe a one-year-old, you know, just being held by my grandfather and just using my finger to push down notes, you know. So that has become my first memory.
Right.
But I don't know that it would have been without the photo.
Right.
You know?
It's interesting how that happens. Sometimes you're like, I don't know if it's a real memory or if it's a memory, a story you've created around the photo because that's what you've seen.
Exactly. We all gravitate towards making these stories, you know, about ourselves in a way to understand our past.
Sure. Well, last time I was over, you showed me that you had some, like, cassette tapes that you had looped yourself as a little kid, where you figured out how to, like, record from tape to tape and put your own voice on multiple times.
Good memory.
How did you figure that out?
Well, that actually would be my first music memory of, like, making something musical.
And how old were you?
Oh, gosh. Maybe six? I want to say six or seven.
Yeah. Did you have a Fisher-Price recorder with the microphone?
Was that
one of yours?
It wasn't one of those. It was my mom's little sort of, not even a boombox. It was the size of like a melodica or, the size of like a large, one of those large bars of Lindt, you know, chocolate. And it had two tape decks on it so that you could dub back and forth.
Right.
And it had a little built-in microphone so that while you were dubbing, you could add your own voice to it. And I discovered that, I recently discovered the Beatles, and I had become obsessed with them. And that's all I wanted to listen to, was the Beatles. And so I would record myself singing Help, and then bounce it from one cassette to another, adding in more layers of my own voice. And then I also discovered that I could slow down the speed of the cassette. So it sort of came out sounding like this, Help. I need some worry. But it was like layered with like 25 voices of just me as a, you know, 6 or 7 year old kid. But that's also like the Beatles introduced me to harmony. And then that was the first time that I realized I could make harmony. I can do it with my own voice. And how exciting is that? But I didn't understand what I was doing. I just knew.
You just did it.
I had to do this and it made me feel good.
Wow. So It's funny that you found that process when you were six, because in a way you're using that process still to create the concert. When you make your little tracks that you send the artists, you yes. usually sing all the backups for them, and you've looped your voice a couple times, and
yes.
you also sometimes do them, and then yes. they have to interpret over Reza times three or four.
Exactly. You know, it's still one of my favorite parts of the process is being able to record my own voice on top of itself 9,000 times.
Thank you, technology.
Yes.
So you weren't born in Canada. You were born in Kuwait, right?
I was born in Karachi, Pakistan. But my mom just went there just to have me, to be with her mom. And then I think a month or two later, came back to Kuwait.
So how much does that heritage inspire the music you create?
Well, I grew up listening to lots of different types of music because my parents were very Western influenced, but also brought all the Indian stuff. So I listened a lot to Indian music, and then, I mean, you know, the Beatles, and all of that kind of stuff, you know, Madonna, Michael Jackson. But, so I guess living in Kuwait, too, I heard a lot of Arabic music, and I was raised as a Muslim, so I have the Arabic tonality sure. of, like, the reciting of the Quran or the call to prayer in me as well, because mm-hmm. I was trained in that. 4 years old.
And you probably heard it all around you.
I heard it all around me as well.
Right. You know? And you can't really escape that when it's just sort of like really ingrained.
Exactly. And so when people ask me about my influences and what growing up there was like, I say that I didn't really think about it, as nobody really does, right?
Well, yeah, you are where you are.
You are where you are. But I try very consciously, I try not to think about it when I'm creating music now, because I just want to try and do whatever's right for a song or right for the project, and just allow all of my impulses to be filtered through all of my influences.
Absolutely. And that's apparent in the way you create. You still perform quite a bit outside the country, correct?
Well, the last 6 years or so, I've been just in Toronto, really. But before that, I was music directing and studying down in New York, and I did a project that took me to Cambodia, which then a year later came to the East Coast of the United States, and we toured around over there.
Where's your favorite place to perform or to visit? Or what's a place you haven't mm-hmm. performed or visited that you'd like to go to with your music?
That's a good question. I've always wanted to do a huge concert, you know, where the backdrop was one of those huge castles or old ruins, you know, like at the Parthenon or, you know, at some big castle in Scotland or something. But I don't know. There are lots of places I'd love to perform. It had to do actually more with the people I'd be performing with.
Right.
But
it also sounds like you're looking for the inspiration of a space, of a mammoth yes. sort of natural kind of space. Or a historical space.
I think that would be amazing, to do an outdoor concert in, as you said, a historical mammoth space. With amazing people.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's actually why I'm so grateful mm-hmm. that we get to do this concert, Tapestries, at Kerner Hall, you know? And it's just a week away, but I am looking forward to it so much, because that the acoustics are the best in Toronto.
Oh, yeah.
The space just hugs you. And yet also, you know, sends the sound out into the universe so everyone can hear it.
Those of you who can't see, Reza is making wild arm gestures right now to demonstrate how sound moves through giant space. So I just thought I'd let you in on that. You also tour sometimes with Andrea Martin, right?
Yes, I do.
Can you tell us a funny Andrea Martin quirk or story?
Oh my gosh. Well, she is as funny as you'd imagine her to be. And maybe what people don't know about her just from watching her on TV is that she is supremely warm, very kind, and very loving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's always nice to hear that and to know that about people who are famous, because sometimes we hear stories that those people are only nice in their public persona but aren't actually that warm behind closed doors. I was very gratified to learn that she is warm backstage and so loving and always looks after me, you know?
Amazing.
Yeah.
So are you still touring with her? Is that still a gig you're...
Yeah. Well, we're talking about some other dates, and it really is always up to her and her schedule. You know, she's busy in rehearsals right now for the new version of Pippin, which is sort of circus-based. And so Amazing. She's up on a trapeze and doing all kinds of things like that. When I saw her in Ottawa, we did a show just in Ottawa recently. She's always in great shape. And now she had that extra tone of, I'm on a trapeze all the time. And it was amazing.
Does she joke about being up in the air?
Yeah, she does.
I would imagine that would be a good source of funnies for her. So both of us have spent time in New York living, working, whatever. Just curious, you know, as a fellow New York lover, what are some of your favorite spots, like places to eat or shop or theaters? New York's in your heart when you've lived there.
Yeah, it is, you know, and it'll never leave from being in my heart or under my skin, you know. I was just thinking yesterday about Sundays, lazy Sundays in New York. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of people have that as their favorite thing, you know, but it's like the wandering and finding a great place to eat brunch and then sort of just wandering through the park, down to Columbus Circle. I remember I was dating someone at that time, right before I left, and we would walk down all the way up from Morningside Heights, walk down on Amsterdam Avenue, and in the 80s, find somewhere to go for brunch, cross over into the park, walk inside the park, down, and then usually, just as we were getting hungry again, I'm always hungry, we'd go over to the Williams-Sonoma near Columbus Circle, and they always have free samples of their olive oil and like bread and whatever it was. And so, you know, being the starving artist, or at least playing that role, you know, go in there and sample all the fine things and watch the fancy people buy it.
It's funny you say lazy Sundays in New York, because I never found lazy Sunday in New York. No. I always felt so much pressure to engage the city fully.
Yes.
That, you know, getting that Time Out magazine would stress me out, because I would go, I'd read it cover to cover and circle, you know, 49 things I wanted to do, and then realize that I was never going to be able to accomplish all of them.
Yes.
And that I was going to have to choose. And that was so horrifying.
It's heartbreaking.
It was heartbreaking.
It's like the program for The Fringe or for TIFF.
I know.
You know?
Exactly. But it's like the whole city.
Yeah.
Oh, New York.
Yeah.
But it's funny. You spent time, I guess, because Columbia was further north.
Yes.
What about your time at NYU? Did you have a bit of a romantic time with the lower half of the of the island? Because I was all in Soho and lower Manhattan when I was there.
Well, my love affair was really with East Village. Like, I loved it down there.
Yeah.
I lived on 5th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenue.
Yeah.
And I lived there for 3 years, and I just loved it. I mean, that's...
Did you ever see concerts at Arlene's Grocery?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
But I've heard of Arlene's Grocery, and it's on my list of things. We've talked about it, actually.
Yes.
On my list of things to do. I have to say that, like, I also connected with East Village, not just for what it is, the place it is, but I was much more in my own skin and comfortable with myself when I lived there doing my master's degree at NYU, much more so than I was as an undergraduate, you know, crossing from my late teens into my early 20s at Columbia. And I think where you are and how you feel as a person really informs how you remember a place.
Totally.
You know?
Do you have any, famous sightings or people you can't believe you bumped into or saw in New York?
Oh, gosh. I know there are. Oh, but I just can't remember them right now. What would they be? I remember when I was in Philadelphia at the orientation. I was 17 years old, and we had our orientation, sort of a dinner and get-together at the school. And Harry Connick Jr. just walked in off the street. He just played a show. And he just walked in and said, it looks like there's a party going on. I can't sound like him, but it looks like there's a party going on. I just wanted to see what was up. And I remember they introduced Gary Graffman, who's a famous classical pianist and was the head of Curtis, to him. And Gary Graffman had no idea who Harry Connick Jr. was. But
you all did.
Oh, yeah. We all knew who he was. You know? And
embarrassing.
So, yeah. But it was fun, you know?
Absolutely. Did you ever see a concert at the Apollo?
Yes, I did. What did I see? Oh, I think I went to one of those, what's it called?
The amateur night?
Yeah, amateur night at the Apollo.
Yeah,
yeah,
I did that too. That was one
of
my first trip to New York. We saw the best of amateur night. Someone fully came with the cane and pulled somebody off the stage. And they weren't even that bad. It seemed like it was just mostly for the effect of that happening.
We got to give them one.
Yeah. Throw
at least one gladiator to the lions.
But the history of that place all the major performers that came
out. Oh, my gosh.
Just incredible.
It's like Massey Hall.
Yeah, absolutely. Of New York. So
yeah.
A little more romanticized than Massey Hall. So what artists would you love to see acting up stage have in future concerts to interpret your music? Like what dream, ultimate, forget the city, who would you love to sing your reinterpreted work?
Oh, well, I mean, if I'm just, I'll talk about people not in the city. Idina Menzel, I would love to have do something.
Sure.
That's one of the names that sort of comes to mind. But really, it's really about, like, I don't sort of lie awake lusting after, you know, collaborations with certain artists because, having said that, I'll also mention Brent Carver.
Brent, are you listening?
Brent, are you listening?
Reza wants to work with you.
Yes, you know. but I really believe that people come into our lives as they're supposed to, and the right performers end up working with us.
Absolutely. You know? And the right artist in general.
And the right artist in general. And like, and if I'm not the right person to collaborate with someone else, then I hope the universe just won't send me there.
Right. You know? Totally. So, what's next for you? What's the rest of your year look like? I know you're involved in some stuff with us. Maybe you could tell us a bit about your next few things.
Well, I am music directing the remount of Assassins, which Birdland and Takis Free Theater is doing, that's going to Winnipeg.
Do you get to go to Winnipeg?
I do get to go to Winnipeg to take it through tech and through to opening. And then James Smith, a very talented, very reliable music director, pianist, and more importantly, a dear friend of mine, will be taking over the reins and seeing that through the run. I will return here and rehearse a piece called Sanctuary Song, which is an opera with theater direct that's going to go to the NAC and do some performances there. And then soon after that, I'll be in rehearsals for Falsettos, which Acting Upstage is doing, which I can't wait for. We finally got our cast all settled.
Finally!
And I know, right? And it's...
it was a very long casting process.
It was a very long casting process, which was necessary for all the pieces to fall into place.
Yep.
And...
in a way, it's harder to cast a smaller show.
Yes.
Because all the pieces need to balance than casting a show with 15 people in it.
Absolutely. You know? And so, we have a great ensemble, and I can't wait to work with these people, and I can't wait to be in the room again with Robert.
Robert McQueen.
He's a phenomenal director who always connects with the humanity of these characters.
Awesome. Are there any more questions from the Stratosphere? No more questions from the Stratosphere. Well, I want to thank you all so much for listening to Reza and I discuss today, and we hope we will see you at Tapestries on Monday, November the 26th at 8 p.m.
Yes,
at Kerner Hall. Please come. It is quite a magical evening. We would love to see you there.